after day. Alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Draper, a contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine and National Geographic, and a correspondent for GQ. He is the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. His new book just out is Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Draper.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And clearly your book is getting a lot of attention, breaking news. And the one piece of that's got most people's attention, and certainly mine, is that on the very day of the inauguration of President Barack Obama, which was an inspiring moment with 1.8 million people flocking in the mall on this bitterly cold day to celebrate this extraordinary event. Later that day, on that evening, Newt Gingrich and others got together, including Eric Cantor, a very prominent member of the House leadership, to plot the downfall of the Obama administration, literally talk about strangling in its cradle. And believe it or not, much of what they have plotted has come to pass.
Well, it's, just to be clear, Ian, it wasn't intended to be like some dark conspiracy. It was basically 15 leading Republicans who are getting together to drown their sorrows because it had been a very depressing day for them. And so it was more just a, you know, kind of crying on each other's shoulders, at least conceptually. But in the course of their discussion at this place called the Caucus Room, which is a famous Washington steakhouse, they began, first of all, to elaborate on what had gone wrong, why Republicans had lost their way. And in the course of it, then began to discuss how they would dig themselves out of this hole. And what they concluded was that they needed to show unity, that they could not attack this very popular president, at least at that point, on a personal level, but that they should attack all, his agenda, and to do so unanimously if possible, to attack all vulnerable Democrats, and to use this as a pathway to 2010, when they would then hopefully win the House of Representatives, and thereafter use the House as the point of the spear against the Obama administration. And you're correct that that indeed has come to pass.
So what is the of course, the fact of the matter is that Congress is at an abysmally low 9% approval rating. And in many ways, one wonders who these 9% are, prompting the veteran House member from Detroit to say, what is it we're about?
John Dingell. John Dingell. I think even pedophiles could do better.
So, but what's interesting about your book is not just that it talks about this insurgency with the 87 House freshmen, the so-called Tea Party caucus, but also it chronicles what went wrong in a way when the Democrats had the trifecta. I'm always astounded that of the historical analogies here, that, you know, when Bill Clinton was elected, he had the trifecta. The Democrats had the trifecta. Right. They had the presidency, the House, and the Senate. 2 years later, a revolution took place, and the House, was taken over by Newt Gingrich. In many ways, I think the American people are very pragmatic. You know, whenever one party gets all three branches of the government, they expect something to get done. And in the first 2 years of Clinton, not for any fault of his own, largely he got more trouble from his own caucus than he did from the Republicans. He had that 94 rebellion blow up in his face, and then the same thing happened this time.
Sure, I think it's a pretty apt analogy, but where I think those two presidencies diverge is that Barack Obama took office as the economy was going south. Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, had been licking her chops, waiting for a Democratic president. She said that when George W. Bush finally left the Oval Office after 8 years, that it was like a big boulder had been lifted from her shoulders. What she meant by this was that at last she would be able to pass a sweeping progressive agenda. However, By the time Barack Obama was sworn in as president, I don't think that many Americans had an appetite for a sweeping progressive agenda. What they wanted more than anything else was for this new untried president to heal an ailing economy. And so when first the Democrats passed a $780 billion stimulus plan, and then followed it up with a cap-and-trade bill that did not seem to bear any relationship to the economic times, and then followed that up with a sweeping health care bit of legislation, they essentially walked into the narrative that the Republicans that night of January 20th, 2009 were just hoping that the Democrats would walk into a kind of quagmire in which they could allow Republicans to say, look, the Democrats aren't interested in joblessness. They're not interested in helping out struggling Americans. They're only interested in passing their big government agenda. And I think that's that was the story that that laid the predicate for the Republican takeover in November 2010.
And Robert Draper, that was the moment when the left lost the narrative that the right wing picked up, the far right wing in the form of the Tea Party, the public outrage against what happened on Wall Street and the bailout. And that was that vacuum was filled by the Tea Party. And I've always been astounded why the Democrats and the political left in this country were asleep. And they only woke up with the Occupy movement years later.
Sure. No, and in fact, you know, I write in the book about how in August of 2009, the aforementioned John Dingell, who is 85 years old, has served in the House for 57 years, longer than anyone in the history of that institution, faced one of the first very vitriolic town halls relating to Obamacare. And, you know, the people were literally screaming in his face. And though Mr. Dingell is quite adept at answering questions relating to health care, he hardly knew what to do with such an emotional response. And after two such town halls, told his staff there wasn't any point doing this anymore. At that point, the Democratic narrative really did get slip away from itself. And in 2010, Democrats, even the moderate Blue Dog Democrats who were often opposed to the Nancy Pelosi agenda, found attack ads in their district with their faces up against or adjoining an image of Nancy Pelosi as if the two were evil twins. And this, I think more than anything else, is why these 87 freshmen were elected on this Tea Party wave and allowed John Boehner to become Speaker in January 2011.
Again, I'm speaking of Robert Draper, the author of the new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. And it's just hard to understand, though, why that was a fleeting moment in time, that the stimulus wasn't big enough, why the president thought the Republicans would cooperate with him. Nancy Pelosi apparently tried to tell him otherwise. I've spoken to Robert Putnam up at Harvard, who knew Obama when he was there, and said Obama would love these weekend seminars they'd have, the Sequoia seminars, where, you know, Ralph Reed would be sitting down next to a union organizer and Obama would be mediating and this kind of stuff. It seems that he is that kind of person, but this has been so brutally partisan, and much of it's to do with what happened with this 87 freshmen, right? They simply don't want to take any prisoners. They don't believe in compromise.
Well, maybe further to the point, Ian, they earnestly believed that they were elected and given a mandate by the public to roll back the Obama administration. Now, this is not uncommon. We've seen a number of waves in the House of Representatives. I mean, beginning with after the corrupt Grant administration, when I think something like 80 or so Democratic freshmen were brought in, and when FDR came in 1932, beating Herbert Hoover, he was accompanied by 131 Democratic freshmen. And in each case, this goes on and on through, you know, Watergate, the Newt Gingrich Revolution, the Pelosi takeover in 2006. And in each case, they perhaps overinterpret or exaggerate the mandate that they believe the people have given them, to enact sweeping change, when, in my suspicion, what the public is really saying is not so fast, slow down. Instead, what happens is that the public gets whipsawed then with the House attempting a 180-degree reversal of what the previous House had done. And that's what we began to see in 2011, where the House Republicans very much, I think, you know, controlled more by these 87 Tea Party freshmen than by Speaker Boehner, began to aggressively attempt to roll back not only all Obama initiatives, but basically any Democratic initiatives over the last several years, and certainly that would include spending.
But there's something different about the Tea Party people in the sense that they don't, you know, they don't believe in compromise and consensus, and you have this situation now where essentially the total gridlock, and I don't understand why the public don't recognize that you don't hire these people to do your political work if they are this inflexible, and that they might as well be just, you know, what's the difference between them and Tea Party protesters on the street? I mean, it's,
right. Well, I think you're right, Ian. In fact, I remember in the book chronicles this going to see a town hall of Corpus Christi, Texas Tea Party freshman Blake Farenthold, in which, you know, he laments in front of his audience that, you know, it's a divided government and there's really not much you can do but compromise. And then people in the audience stand up and start yelling at him and say, we didn't send you to Washington to compromise. On the one hand, I suppose you can respect the fact that they have a belief system, that they believe that they are there essentially on a mission that the public has sent them drastically reduce government spending. On the other hand, anyone with a pair of eyes can see that the guys in the Senate who are in control are Democrats. The man sitting in the White House is a Democrat, and you're simply not, for example, going to get the Ryan budget passed with its Medicare entitlement reforms, with massive tax cuts, with massive cuts in government spending, and expect Democrats to go along. It just won't happen. And so, yes, that's the recipe for paralysis as we've seen it over the last year and a half.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Draper, the author of the new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives, a title, of course, coming from a 200-year-old cautionary tale lamented by Fisher Ames, in many ways the father of the First Amendment to the Constitution, talking about the House of Representatives that he was leaving in disgust, this is in disgust towards its zero-sum machinations. What I like about the book, though, and much of the publicity is about Eric Cantor and his guerrilla war to undermine Boehner. This Cantor, of course, being at that original meeting on the day of Obama's inauguration.
And Boehner, by the way, not being at that.
And then, right, and Cantor just seems to be a kind of a ruthless and determined player. And I think Boehner is still of that old school, but you know, he compromises a dirty word now. So I don't see his chances of surviving that looking that good. But again, you focus a lot on the Democratic side and what many feel is, you know, that wish they would have gotten more done, not wasted all their time on cap and trade and these and this tortured health care bill. A great anecdote in the book about Anthony Weiner, the disgraced congressman, this before, of course, he was taking pictures of his crotch and putting them on the internet. He was flying in Air Force One, and he went on to argue for the single payer system with President Obama. And Obama says, "Well, I don't have the votes for that." And then Anthony Weiner countered, "Mr. President, you only have votes for something when you go out and fight for them." And then Obama half jokingly concluded the conversation by saying, "Well, enjoy your last ride on Air Force One."
What? No, and of course, there are a couple of ways to look at that conversation and about the Democratic legislative agenda in 2011. 2009 and 2010 writ large. And on the one hand, and it's been pointed out, I believe someone from the New York Times wrote an op-ed in response to that anecdote as I printed a couple of days ago, you could make the argument, as this columnist did, that that Weiner had it right, that President Obama could have and should have fought for a single-payer system. And in a lot of ways, you even see conservatives saying it would have been a more intellectually honest approach to universal health care. On the other hand, there were some strategic errors, I think, that the Democrats committed in 2009 and 2010, which, again, laid a path for the Republicans to take over. One of them was, as you mentioned, Ian, you can make an argument about the stimulus having been too small. What Pelosi and others told the president was that the votes just weren't there for a bigger stimulus. But what you could certainly make an argument for, and many blue dog Democrats did to Speaker Pelosi, was let's not, after the stimulus, then lead with cap and trade legislation. Most people don't understand why we're doing this in such an economic climate. Health care is a heavy lift. Let's do that now. If we actually have to muster so much energy for a cap and trade bill that is certain to fail in the Senate, and then try to go for a health care bill, we're going to find that we've lost a lot of momentum, a lot of our narrative, and a lot of votes. And that's unfortunately precisely what did take place. And it dragged a health care debate on for such a period of time that the Democrats sort of lost all coherence. And by the end of it all, famously couldn't explain the bill to the extent that Nancy Pelosi said, we'll have to pass the bill to see what's in it. And that, of course, has been one of the most memorable taglines of the 111th Congress.
And, of course, Nancy Pelosi, who was pushing cap and trade, probably because of her support from the environmental lobby, she then gets reelected, even though I think her leadership was pretty disastrous.
Well, and the reason she was reelected is because there really was no one else among the House Democrats who had her fundraising clout. If you presuppose that the way to get back is to, raise a ton of money so that you can recruit new candidates and so you can run a slew of attack ads across the nation, then Nancy Pelosi's the person to raise that money. But as a lot of, recently defeated Blue Dog Democrats said to Nancy Pelosi's face at a Democratic caucus shortly after the midterms, this is something that's written about in detail in the book, they told her, you're the face of defeat. And as long as the opposition can put up your face in an attack ad next to whatever candidate we're running, it hardly matters what that candidate's virtues are. People will just see Nancy Pelosi and they will vote against that person. And which also, of course, is why there was a banner on the Republican National Committee headquarters that said fire Pelosi throughout the 2010 cycle. And then right after the 2010 cycle, they replaced that banner with hire Pelosi, because she's the gift that keeps on giving for the Republicans.
Well, Robert Draper, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives.
Thanks very much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Draper, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and National Geographic, and he's also a correspondent for GQ. He's the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller Dead Certain, The Presidency of George W. Bush. His new book just out is Do Not Ask What Good We Do, Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with former CIA officer Robert Baer, who George Clooney played in the movie Syriana. We're talking to him about a year ago. We spoke to him about the former head of Israel's Mossad going public and warning that Netanyahu was losing it and wanted to attack Iran. We were talking about how the head of Shin Bet, the equivalent of the FBI, just has gone public and saying, I do not believe in a leadership that makes decisions based on messianic feelings. I have seen Netanyahu and Barak up close. They are not messiahs, these two, and they are not the people I personally trust to lead Israel into such an event. Very outspoken. Clearly there's something going on in Israel that's alarming its intelligence and political and military leaders. So we talked about that, and it's an irony, of course, that in a moment when Hezbollah is in so much trouble inside Lebanon for supporting the Assad regime, who are murdering their own people in this and the broader proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran that's going on in the region, it would seem that Iran is very much on the defensive, not to mention the enormous squeeze from the sanctions that the Israeli leadership. Bob Baer doesn't believe they are bluffing. He thinks they're actually crazy, which is quite alarming. And then we spoke with Perry Link, who's been blacklisted from China. Now I understand why he was blacklisted. He's the guy that took the leading dissident from the Tiananmen Square to the U.S. Embassy, where he was holed up for a whole year. And a history now is repeating itself, where a prominent Chinese dissident is now apparently holed up in the U.S. Embassy. And this is all happening on the eve of Secretary of State Clinton's visit to meet with the Chinese leadership, who have just recently been embarrassed by this wiretapping by one of their members of the Politburo. Apparently, they all wiretap each other. It's the whole thing. Chinese Politburo is akin to the mafia. Finally, I spoke with Robert Draper. His new book is creating quite a stir, Do Not Ask What Good We Do, about how the Republicans plotted on the very day of Obama's inauguration to do him in, and a lot of their plans seem to be coming true. But the book really does explain why the Democrats dropped the ball in the House so badly and in the White House in those first years of the Obama administration. And very, very much worth reading. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also get in touch with me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.